Oh, that's right. You're in for a treat this afternoon. Get ready to take off with Dr. Iroh Williams. He likes to say he's had three careers. He's been a U.S. Air Force retired major, a senior navigator and private pilot. He was in South Korea, and he was activated out of his internship for the Cuban crisis in 1962. But that's just the beginning of the story. He's also board-certified oral and facial surgeon, I'll just say it that way because I don't think I can say those big words, and an anesthesiologist. He's also an expert in medical malpractice litigation and medical peer review. He's written three books, and he's here to talk, I want to talk about some of his past, but he's here to talk about his latest book, Find the Black Box, that has to do with healthcare. How you doing today, Dr. Iroh Williams?
Doing great, Ann. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Bumped into you when I was up there in Greenville at the Freedom Summit. You were wearing your U.S. Air Force retired hat, and I happened to turn around and thank you for being a veteran and for your service. And you said, but that's not all I do, Ann. Yeah. So, you know, curiosity, how did you, you were telling me just before we went on the air, how you ended up in the Air Force. You went to school in Memphis, graduated, what, a year before, a year after Elvis?
No, I was a year and a half older than Elvis. I graduated in 51.
Okay.
And joined a reserve unit that year, and which in 53 led me to go to aviation cadets. And in 54, I was commissioned a second lieutenant when I was still 20 years old. 3 months before my 21st birthday.
But didn't you
birthday.
See a sign as you were driving back and forth that made you decide to jump in?
When I registered at Memphis State Teachers College at the time, now Memphis University, I joined an Air Force ROTC. But when I passed the airport and saw the sign for the new reserve unit, I went and joined, so I dropped ROTC. And
you were taking typing in school.
I had taken typing in high school for some reason. I have no idea why. And that led me to a job where I was the only lowly airman in a M&S group command that was surrounded by a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, a major, a bunch of captains. And that led me to some way find out they were taking applications for cadets for the Air Force. And so I took the test in early 53, went to Lackland at San Antonio for 12 weeks, and then down to Harlingen. Got my commission in April 54 when I was 20. Got my wings in June and could have come to Greenville at Donelson, but decided to go to South Korea where they had World War II medium bombers, because the next year we came back and got in one of the new jet bombers. We were flying at 50,000 feet in 1955.
You were telling me how you actually opened up Fort Walton Beach.
Yes, where our unit island hopped from Japan across the Pacific and across the United States, and we opened Eglin 9 Hurlburt. We were the first unit to open that base in 1955.
Now, what kind of feeling? I mean, because you hadn't flown that high before. 50,000 feet was...
Almost no one had that.
Right, that's
we were pushing the envelope. And when you look up there, the blue turns black. It's total black. It's space.
Is it really?
Because you're above all the particles that reflect the sunlight. And so when you look up, it's black. And
pitch
and,
black?
And at, you know, 21, 22, that was exciting.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And of course, then you were part of the Cuban crisis.
I was called at midnight and said, "Be at the base in the morning. You're back in." And I was at that time. I was near the end of my internship and was going to apply for oral surgery training. And I thought, "Oh, I'm gone for a year." They kept. I spent 5 days at Homestead. It was.
They had everybody just kind of in a holding pattern, right?
My flight, my crew, we went down because it was after They had canceled everything.
Okay.
And Kennedy was supposed to come down and review the different units. And we were there 5 days waiting for him to show up. He was never able to, but our unit received the presidential unit citation for the Cuban crisis. And a month later, they walked in one day and said, "You can go home." And I applied for oral surgery and went to Milwaukee.
Now, what was the reason? I thought it was real interesting. You were telling me off the air. What was the reason that you signed up to begin with?
Signed up for the Air Force?
The Air Force to begin with.
Well, I didn't have a clue what I was going to do.
Right.
And I was a very poor student. I was a gross underachiever and immature, to say the least. And the Air Force, in being a commissioned officer, allowed me to gain the maturity to come back and go through dental school and internship and oral surgery training. I'd have never done that otherwise. In fact,
did they have the slow program, or did you pick up speed?
My last assignment in the Air Force on active duty, I reported to Blytheville Air Force Base, 100 miles from Memphis, and walked on the base, thought I'd be assigned to one of the three squadrons, and ended up being the wing headquarters squadron commander. And the next day, they made me assistant summary court-martial officer. And this brings up an important thing about healthcare.
Okay.
And this is what contributes to my latest book. I learned there, accountability is a byproduct of authority or delegated authority. There is no accountability unless there's sufficient authority to obtain it.
Well, and, you know, that's very true. And that's one thing that the armed services in general, I think, is real good in the past. I don't know about today, but in the past, it was real good at teaching people.
Well, but that brings up another important point.
Okay.
The military could not exist without an organizational structure.
Yes.
And levels of delegated authority throughout. In my second and third book, I point out our healthcare system is devoid of any organizational structure. You cannot find any organizational characteristics in our system. And that's why I brought copies of four books, my three. And the fourth book is the book that compelled me to write my last book.
Okay.
And the title of that book is Unaccountable, and it was written by a surgeon at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Marty McCary, who is one of the recognized patient safety experts in the country. And if you read his book and my book, then you start to see what's always been missing in healthcare and within the medical profession.
Sure. You know, we're going to get into all that. Actually, what I was asking you was about how you told me you saw a sign and they told you at age 60 you got retirement benefits, and you thought that that was just awesome being 18 or 19.
When I joined the reserves, when I went in and started talking to the sergeant that was, quote, recruiting me, and again, I just graduated from high school in June and had just signed up at Memphis State, and he said, you know, if you stay in and get 20 good years, when you reach 60, you'll get a retirement check. And I remember distinctly saying, well, who wouldn't do that? And I did.
And you did, yeah.
I got 25 between the Reserve and the Tennessee Air National Guard and the Wisconsin Air National Guard. And I was a liaison officer for the Air Force Academy. I was commissioned the year they started the Air Force Academy in 54.
Wow.
And I spent a week out there in the 70s, and I've talked a few young people into going there. I think it's one of the most fantastic places for an education any young person, male or female, could go.
You know, that is so awesome. And, you know, you and I were talking before we came on the air about things were simpler even though we didn't realize it.
Oh,
and, you
yeah.
know, we look at today's world and the complexities and all the things that we deal with day in and day out and the bureaucracy that just the paperwork, whether you're a doctor or a human being just trying to do your taxes, the paperwork is phenomenal.
Well, I have recently come to realize that agencies, federal and state agencies, have a shelf life. And we don't realize that. When they're first created, for the best of reasons, but within time, they all become bureaucracies, shuffling paper. And if you closely examine, and I try to do that in my second and third book on healthcare, you come to find out that most agencies would have difficulty justifying their existence if anyone would examine them closely, because after a while, their first priority becomes to self-preservation. And so I think just the nature of federal and state agencies is that within a certain length of time, they're going to get to where they do more harm than good.
That is why, perhaps, the federal government should move to another location and have to start over.
Most of it, sure.
Yeah. And therefore, we would do away with a lot of things, because if you had to move it, you would look at it and say, do we need it or
exactly.
do we not?
Exactly.
Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with Dr. Ira Williams. This is going to be a fascinating and I think probably a fast hour here this afternoon. Sure hope you're going to stay tuned. If you've got a question or a comment, please don't hesitate to give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
They say every kiss begins with, but at Sharp Facets Gallery, every smooch begins with Sharp Facets Gallery. Which do you want? A little kiss or a big smooch? I'll bet a big smooch. So shop Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood, for rock bottom prices and smooch. A bull results.
That's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I am Ann Eller, and my very special guest, Dr. Ira Williams. He's written three books. His latest book, Find the Black Box, and we're going to be talking about that as it relates to healthcare. But real quick, before we launch into all this other stuff, why did you go to become an oral surgeon?
During my internship, I spent most of my time with the oral surgeon at the VA in Memphis, who had been in a MASH unit in World War II in Europe. And I just got to where I loved oral surgery.
Oh.
And he recommended that I apply for one of the residencies, and was fortunate to be accepted to the one at the VA and Marquette University in Milwaukee. And the first day there, I was assigned to training in anesthesia by the chief of anesthesia. Had been in MASH units in Europe, where he could do four ether cases at a time.
Four?
And he came back when situation demanded it. And he came back and started the first department of anesthesia at Ohio State in 47. And I got him in Milwaukee in 63. And he is the one that came up with recovery rooms, ICUs, code blues. And when I first started writing my first book in 2003, I started trying to make contact with him. He had just retired. Mm-hmm. In South Florida, and I called him, said I was beginning to write a book on medical malpractice. His name was Dr. Jacoby. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, Ira, I've been thinking about doing that too. And I said, I need to come down, so we can talk. And about 6 weeks later, a son-in-law called me and said he had passed away.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonderful man.
So your interest in malpractice, because I know one of the things that you actually did was you were an authority on this.
Well, what started, I had several patients who had really negligent care by other surgeons.
Right.
And I didn't choose them. They happened to walk in and had a problem, and their care was transferred to me. And in the two biggest cases, the previous surgeons had done everything wrong, nothing right.
Wow.
And I didn't say anything to the patients, but the first case, I referred it to the peer review system at the Catholic Hospital in Madison, and it went through all the levels, all the way up to the Sisterhood in St. Louis. And they all kept saying they did nothing wrong, but eventually when the patient sued, they were found guilty of malpractice. But I had broken the code of silence, and so economically they ran me out of town.
Wow.
I was forced to leave the group practice I was in, and at that time HMOs were starting in Madison. And lo and behold, I was the only board-certified oral surgeon who wasn't accepted as a provider in all the HMOs. So economically, I had to finally leave town. So I came to South Carolina in 90.
Wow.
And I haven't practiced since, but it led me to write my three books, and I believe I'm right where I'm supposed to be.
Now, as far as malpractice, you know, today, malpractice, the dollars are just phenomenal, when a case is made and everything. And, of course, part of what I think has driven some doctors out of practice is the cost of malpractice insurance.
Well, I despise the term medical malpractice.
Right.
In my books, I say I prefer the term questionable patient care, is it or isn't it?
Okay.
And unfortunately, the medical profession has always left the public with sue or forget it. You have to get an attorney to get an answer.
Right.
And because they've never been able to fairly use medical peer review, and sadly, there are three systems that have the potential to review questionable care: medical examining boards, medical peer review, and litigation. And all three of those systems, each for its own reasons, have been abject failures. But medical peer review is the only system where doctors would be in control, but they don't know how to do it. I can show them how to fairly peer review other doctors.
Well, is it a fear that, you know, the doctor did make a mistake, so we don't want to expose that it's a very close-knit group?
They've thrown everything out of context. They in their literature, they'll say, oh, if we show this doctor made a mistake, it'll cost him his career, which is nonsense. What it comes down to is that we have around 5,000, give or take, hospitals. Therefore, 5,000 hospital medical staffs. Mm-hmm. And they're all dominated by the code of silence. And if you read the books, read the literature, even by many doctors, they'll tell you no one can say anything. If they see another doctor harm a patient, they can't say anything. And the sad fact is, if they knew how to properly use medical peer review, it would save their profession.
And probably save patients' lives.
Yeah.
Because we would have better doctors, and because we would have a logical review in situations.
Yeah. I believe, they talk a lot about doctor burnout, and I believe the major factor of this is that they live a lie. They know every day they can't say anything. And they know if I judge another doctor, sooner or later they'll come and judge me, and I know we don't know how to do that, and it's their own fault.
Wow. Now, this is some explosive stuff we're going to be talking about here this afternoon on WCRS. So you got to stay tuned. If you have a question, I know a lot of you are going. I know exactly what he's talking about. I happen to know of doctors' groups that they only associate with other doctors. They don't associate with regular folk, do they? Hey, I'm talking here now, and I'm with Dr. Ira Williams. We have the name of his latest book, Find the Black Box. We're going to talk more about that and a whole lot more. Sure hope you're going to stay tuned right here on WCRS.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. I tell you what, we're right back here. I'm Ann Eller here with Dr. Ira Williams. He's had three careers. Who knows? He may have a fourth or a fifth before he's finished here. He was U.S. Air Force retired. He was going to South Korea in 1954. He was in the Cuban crisis in 1962. And he certainly has given a lot of service. He is also board-certified oral surgeon, anesthesiologist, and he is very, very concerned about what's happening with healthcare. And, you know, we've had these conversations before, so am I. So, Dr. Williams, what we were just talking about what is happening with the hospitals, of course, are buying out a lot of practices. We used to have a lot of surgery centers where one could go outside the hospital and have surgery. And other than a few inside, like I know my plastic surgeon has an office, has a surgery center, a lot of them are disappearing. What's happening out there?
Well, we keep calling this thing a system.
Okay.
And it's not a system. When someone gets sick or injured, they look for a doctor in a hospital.
Right.
That's a delivery system, and that's my area of expertise. Not how to pay for health care after the fact, but the delivery system. And I want to read you a quote. Even if you cured cancer, you couldn't get it to the people because the medical system is broken.
And what does that mean?
All right, well, a Dr. Spence Taylor in Greenville, who was head of the committee setting up the new medical school at Greenville Hospital, said that 5 years ago.
Okay.
And the editor of the weekly newspaper that took that quote skipped a line, put a new heading, and didn't say, what do you mean by that? But I've told the governor, I've told several legislators, and no one seems to blink an eye that the healthcare system is broken.
So it's getting bigger and stronger all the time.
Well,
how can it be broken?
All right, I'm going to give you the best known information about why it's broken.
Okay.
Every new estimate of needless hospital deaths has been greater than all previous estimates for the past 25 years. In 1990, a group of doctors estimated needless hospital deaths annually at 98,000, or about 268 a day.
Okay. Those are needless deaths now.
Yeah, shouldn't have had. They call them never events. Oops.
Oops. Okay.
Oops. You don't want to be an oops.
Right. Because you won't be coming back if you're an oops.
Yeah.
Okay.
The latest estimate recognized by those quality of healthcare and patient safety experts is quadruple that estimate in 25 years. Things are going in the wrong direction.
You would think that they would be coming because we're becoming much more sophisticated in our ability to cure things and do things in the medical field. All the information that people are learning about the genetics and how this affects and how environment affects and all the effects of things, it should be going the other way.
Well, and that's my point in my second and third book. My second book, Misdiagnosed, Why Current Healthcare Changes Malpractice in 2010, was, I believe, maybe the first and probably the only attempt to describe the organizational structure of healthcare. And I said on the back flyer of that book, our healthcare system has evolved like a weed patch, no master gardener. There is no organization.
That can get very overgrown very fast.
All right, but here's the point all the experts have missed.
Okay.
I'm going to give you three fundamental facts. Two of them are joined at the hip, as I'm concerned. First fact, all medical care is local. Second fact, states license doctors. Put them together, what does that tell you? Each state is responsible to create a healthcare delivery system for their state. Third fact, All 50 state medical examining boards are over 100 years old, and each one has a mission statement containing the phrase to regulate the practice of medicine. But there is no regulatory mechanism within the medical profession. So what you're dealing with is there are a lot of great things going on in healthcare.
Right.
But within the system, there is no organizational structure. So now let me give you another example. South Carolina has about 67 or 8 hospitals.
67 or 68 hospitals.
Yeah. Okay. And 16 rural hospitals are about to go under.
Correct.
The county, Houston, the county that Houston's in, I've got a name block on the county, but that county has 80 hospitals.
And
alone
in Houston, Texas,
just that one
80
just,
hospitals.
Yeah,
so we could literally fix South Carolina within those. Yeah. Yeah,
but the point is, there's no organizational structure within that state or any other state. But see, in the Air Force, I was in Tactical Air Command. Mm-hmm. Headquarters, when I was in Japan, Korea, was 5th Air Force, and the state's 9th Air Force.
Okay.
And they had all the tactical air bases. When they saw something needed to be changed, they could send it down and say, you change it or else. You can't find that in healthcare, and particularly at the level of the medical staff.
You know, that's very interesting because I believe, if I remember correctly, one of the things that has been in front of the House or the Senate this year is the allowing hospitals to expand.
Yeah, that's certificate of need.
Right, and aren't they doing away with that? And just if a hospital says, "Well, I think we'll add this," we can add this.
Well, it's a contentious issue,
right?
And some are for doing away, some are not. But here's what I want to throw out at you.
Okay.
Not only in South Carolina, in every state,
right?
I predict there's not one state in the nation where that governor. Mm-hmm. Can find one person who can say, I can describe in detail our state's healthcare delivery system, name every component, describe how each one functions to some degree, and identify the organizational structure.
Now, who is that under? But who are the hospital systems under?
We have three agencies.
Three.
HHS handles Medicaid.
Okay.
We have the Medical Examining Board, over 120 years old, and they're missing in action. Nobody knows what they do.
Okay.
And you have DHEC, which has over 3,000 people in it. They're trying to do environmental, and they're the ones that decide, can you build a hospital? Can you add on to a hospital? Can you get a big X-ray machine or whatever?
Right.
Can you have open-heart surgery? And they don't have a clue. But the point is, let me give you a quick example. There was an article in Greenville about Michelin Tire Company. Mm-hmm. Just in South Carolina, they have 9 different plants. Very right. Successful.
Okay.
They could not exist without an organizational structure where when the head shed says you do something in the plants, or if you had a problem in a production line,
right.
You fix it. You can't find that in healthcare. See, healthcare, each hospital, say you got a hospital with 1,000 doctors.
Right.
That's 1,000 different lines of production. If you've got some doctors who are not turning out very good quality healthcare,
right.
You need a system to identify them and figure out. No hospital has that system. Every hospital medical staff is dominated by the code of silence. You can't say a word. It's kind of like the three monkeys, you know. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Right.
And it's killing them. And that's why every new estimate of needless hospital deaths is going in the wrong direction. I know how to change that. I can give a plan for a 21st century healthcare delivery system that would blow people's minds.
Well, I tell you what, when we come back, I'll let you blow people's minds. How about that? Hey, don't you go away. We'll be right back.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Oh, I tell you what, you really should be a fly on the wall when we're off the air talking about some of this stuff. It's pretty entertaining and pretty depressing, too. You know, I don't know how many of you caught the article, the letter to the editor that was in the paper, I think it was yesterday, about written by a teacher here in Greenwood. I think it was a middle school teacher, social studies, who was amazed at what people understood about what the Constitution says we should and should not do. And one of the things, Ira, that he says that is not in the federal parlance is health care, that it was not part of the Constitution.
Exactly. The federal government is killing our health care system. Hey, with the best of intentions.
Sure.
But here's something. If you were to start back, as I do in my second book, it 1776 and come forward, 80% of the history of healthcare in America, the first 80%, doctors own the system. And then Lyndon Johnson created Medicare and Medicaid, and the federal government started getting involved.
The
states had created medical examining boards over 100 years ago, but then they thought, well, we've done that, and they have never recognized. So here's one of the points I make. On my website, findtheblackbox.org, I have an open letters page. An open letter number 14 is five great healthcare mistakes. And I think number four or five says this. There are three major components controlling healthcare: federal government, state governments, and medical profession. And they all despise each other. And I said, how are you ever going to create an effective healthcare system when the major component, it's like trying to get peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And until we stop and look at how this system has developed like a weed patch, no organizational structure, and decide it's time to begin to create a 21st century healthcare system, we're never going to get anywhere. And I know how to do that.
How do you do that, Ira?
Well, the first...
Wait a minute. First question. Is anybody paying attention to you out there in the world?
No. For the reason...
Why?
All right. I'm going to tell you this. You do this, the first step is to recognize the state responsibility. And there is an army of quality of health care and patient safety experts who have been trying to improve the current system for the last 30, 40 years, not making real progress. And they don't want to admit I'm right and they're wrong. Unless you recognize each state's responsibility for the delivery system, you'll never get anywhere. Can't.
Okay.
And yet you're left with the fundamental facts. All medical care is local, states licensed doctors, and all 50 state medical examining boards are over 100 years old.
So what's the answer?
Give me a platform and let me force them to recognize the state responsibility for the delivery system so that we can have separate discussions. One, how to pay for health care after the fact, Obamacare, Romney Care, Clinton Care, Medicare, Medicaid, insured, uninsured. But the other, doctors and hospitals, that's a delivery system. Unless you treat them as equally important but different aspects of health care, you're never going to get anywhere. And my expertise is with a delivery system, and I know it inside out.
You know, out of curiosity, because one of the things that, you know, they've talked about in the healthcare system and everything is what is going to happen to doctors. You know, our doctors are, they'll work a 40-hour shift or whatever number of hours shift. They will go home. I mean, we're all used to grow up with the family doctor and the doctor that called up and said, how you doing today, Ann, right, back in the day. And we don't have as much of that because I understand that doctors are just going to be shift workers.
Well, doctors, as far as I'm concerned, are their own worst enemy.
Okay.
And I want to give you an example. If you begin at 1800 and lay out a timeline of the medical profession, periodically one of the famous names will pop up.
Okay.
But if you look closely at every one of them, Semmelweis, Early, Pasteur, all the big names, during their day, they were vilified by the medical leadership because they wanted to control the system for the doctors.
They wanted to rock the boat.
Yeah, and unfortunately, doctors have always been their own worst enemy. When they left society with sue or forget it, get an attorney if you think a doctor harmed you, rather than medical peer review, they chose the wrong path. And I practice surgery, and I realize 99% of the doctors out there are just doctors trying to practice and make a living. They aren't the leadership. They aren't the ones that have chosen this bad path. But if you look at the history, I just finished a book yesterday called Dr. Mutter's Miracles.
Okay.
And he was a prominent surgeon pre-Civil War in Philadelphia.
Okay.
He had a short life, died before he was 50. Great surgeon. He had just written a book on how he could do surgery rapidly without anesthesia at the time they discovered ether and chloroform.
Okay.
But he instantly went to ether and chloroform. Most of the surgeons in Philadelphia vilified that. They said anesthesia is ridiculous. If you go through the history of the medical profession, mm-hmm. time after time after time again, the medical leadership has always been their worst enemy. And they've chosen the wrong path, and it's in their history. It's not something
else. It's in their genes.
Because they've always wanted to be in control. And now that the federal government has taken control of the healthcare system and is killing it, they with the best of intentions, they mean well, but they're literally killing it. This nation is losing daily one of the most important aspects for society. And unless you recognize the state responsibility for the delivery system, you know, when all the Republican leadership says we need to bring things back from the federal government to the, I keep telling them I know how to do that in healthcare, and I can't get any of them to listen to me. I don't understand it. Unless they recognize the state responsibility, and that means you're going to have to make the quality of healthcare and patient safety experts recognize that. You're going to force it down their throat because none of them can dispute what's in my book.
Wow. And yet, how many copies of this book have you sold, Ira?
I don't know for sure, but I've sent several to many of these experts.
Right.
Becker's Hospital Review just printed a list of 50 of the experts. I've sent my book to over a dozen of them. I've only had two doctors get back to me, said it was a wonderful book. Most of them, I think, my book scares the hell out of them because they have never recognized the state responsibility.
Wow. Well, we are here at WCRS right here in Greenwood. Now, just out of curiosity, how would the state, because we got to keep this kind of short, but how would the state take back control?
Well, first they have to understand that this system is not as... So I say in my last two books, the first step is to get them to describe in detail the current system. I can do that. I made an offer to Governor Haley. I can lay out a description for South Carolina's delivery system. And if they saw it, it would scare them to death.
Did she take you up on your offer?
She gave me 10 minutes.
She gave you 10 minutes?
And I hadn't heard from her since. And that was in 2010.
Wow.
And I've talked to many legislators.
Okay.
I have no... I'm one person. I can show an organization who's interested in healthcare, how to become healthcare warriors. I can show an organization how to force the governor and the legislature to do what needs to be done. And the first step is to describe in detail the current system, and that's going to scare the devil out of them, because they're going to look at it and say, it's a non-system. It's ugly. There's nothing there. That would be the second step, to appraise what you see. And then the third step would be, let me lay out my plan. It would take me all day.
Right.
To lay out my plan for a 21st century healthcare delivery system that is based on medical peer review for doctors to review each other. You can't eliminate litigation, but you can certainly reduce the need greatly.
But how much would this cost, Ira? Because somehow I get money as always seems to be at the root of everything.
I could describe in detail, if I had sufficient authority from the governor and legislature, in a 3-month period, over particularly over the summer, if I had the authority to go in the different agencies and everything and say, tell me so I can tell the governor and the legislature, what do you do, how do you do it, what can't you do, what would you like to do, and describe each component, I could do that in probably 3 months, 3 or 4 months. And it would take me less than $1 million, $700-$800, because I'd need a small staff. I know exactly what I need to do and what I want to do. And once they saw what they have, it would be a role model for every other state. Second step is to appraise that and say, this is not acceptable. And then my third step is to create a big tent, to invite experts in. I want to be the first expert to lay out my plan. Won't be perfect. But the different segments, somebody else could say, oh, Ira, this segment, I can make this better. Oh, Ira, this segment, I make... It's like when we decide, when Kennedy said we need men to walk on the moon and return safely, they created a big tent, brought in all these experts, somebody for propulsion, somebody for guidance, somebody for this, somebody for that. That's what I want to do to create a 21st century healthcare delivery system. Create a big tent, but I want to lay out my plan first and then let everybody else start.
Tear it apart and find better pieces.
To add to it.
Right.
And one of the big things, you invite nobody who has a negative attitude under the tent. They got to be positive. They don't want to come in to tell you what's bad. They want to come in to tell you how to make it better.
How to make it better. Wow. What do you think the possibility of that happening, Ira?
Well, who knows?
Who knows?
My faith tells me I will be allowed to do whatever he decides I'll be allowed to do. So I am at peace. And whatever I'm allowed to do, that's what I intend to do.
Now, one more thing. How about any other states out there? I mean, you're talking, of course, about South Carolina. We have 49 other states. What, have any of them approached this in any way?
No, but I'm the only one saying what I'm saying. And because I live in South Carolina, and because it's a perfect size to do this and a perfect layout, I feel that this state could be the role model. Could I do it? I would never try to do this first in California or New York or something that big. But in a state, something like that, I'm from Tennessee. I could do it in Tennessee. I could do it in Georgia. I could do it, I could possibly do it in Florida, although that's getting pretty big. As the first one. But here's the thing. If you ever did it first state,
right,
it would be so simple in another couple of states. And then you turn around and say, all right, the rest of you dummies, if you don't want to do this, keep what you got.
Right. Now, just out of curiosity, we're out of time and I shouldn't keep talking, but I'm going to talk for a second. You, of course, were at the Freedom Summit. And did you get any opportunity to talk to Dr. Ben Carson?
I gave him my card, told him I'd written 3 books. I had tried to send him a copy of my book. But the address that was given to me by someone on the phone, I didn't write down the telephone, the DC address,
mm-hmm.
The book was returned to me. It was probably about the time he was moving to Florida.
Oh, okay.
I would love to have contact with he. I'd love to have contact with Carly because of her business background. I think she can see what I'm talking about maybe faster than politicians.
Yeah.
But I stopped at Duncan's office, mm-hmm, in Lawrence and left him a copy of this letter where I said I can provide a plan for 21st, and I asked if maybe he could make that available to. I said on here, I will share my understanding of the healthcare delivery system with any presidential candidate or their staff healthcare expert upon request.
Well, there you go. Well, you know, this has been a very interesting conversation, but I can see that you're just not getting a lot of respect out there.
I'm the only one saying what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, that's a problem then, isn't it, Ira?
Yeah. And that's why I need things like this.
Okay. Well, I am sure glad you came down to talk to us this afternoon.
And I love it.
Yes, this is Dr. Ira Williams. Now, your book, Find the Black Box, what's your website?
Findtheblackbox.org. And at the bottom of the open letters page, at the very bottom, I have a 1938 short Hollywood movie entitled That Mothers Might Live.
Wow. Absolutely. That's terrific. Well, I certainly hope you've enjoyed the show here today. I sure have enjoyed sitting down and talking to you. And I wish you all the best. And when you start getting famous and start getting some pushback here, I hope you'll give us a call and tell us how it's going.
I'm available at any time, Ann.
All right. That sounds great. Hey, this is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.